Right, here we go. We are on Judges Lesson 2, and we are in Chapter 3 of Judges. So this will be a little bit easier, staying in just one chapter. There, of course, is always a lot to cover, but we always need to take a step back at really what we're doing in Judges. So the whole entire book of Judges is about idolatry. And this is always a tough way. How many of people have ever even heard much preaching on the book of Judges? Very little, right? Very little. It's really tough to study into idolatry. Number one, because when we hear the word idols or idolatry, we think them, right? Those people did that. Those people had idols. We don't think us and idols. In fact, we flippantly use the word idols, right? I mean, we have a show called American Idols, right? I mean, idols to us is not a big deal because we don't have idols. So it's always difficult to go into a book like Judges, which the entire book is about idolatry. It's about what it looks like. And God is always very good about when he tells us to do something or not to do something, he always gives us very concrete, experiential stories about what it looks like if you are in idolatry. When he says, have no other gods before me, then he shows us what it looks like. I did. Thank you. So it's always hard then to get into a book of Judges because of the words, idolatry and idols. And we don't think about that. And even for us, when we're talking about these enemies that are always against them, we don't have enemies within our country so much so. So we have a little harder time grasping that. So we need to look back at what does God tell them about idols, what idols will do to them, and parse that out a little bit so that as we're looking through Judges and as we're looking at the enemies here, the people that they're subservient to, what they're doing, that we begin to internalize that as we're just like them. And I think this is a difficult task. I think we will always want to separate ourselves from the people who have idols. But hopefully as we talk about idolatry here at the beginning, we'll begin to understand the pervasiveness of idolatry within our own place. Where we live, not just the big culture of America, but the little cultures of even our families. So what we need to know is what has God already told them about idols? Because, by the way, the people in this book of Judges, they are just as clueless as we are about the fact that they're bowing down to idols. So you need to understand that. It's not obvious to them that they're bowing down to idols. And you're going to see that as we go along, but it is just part of the culture and what they have to do to kind of be in the culture. So it's not any more obvious to them than it is to us today. So what did God tell them about idols? First of all, he said to them in Deuteronomy 7:4, before they go in, remember all of Deuteronomy is, hey, I'm preparing you to what's going to happen when you go in, and here's part of it. This is what idols will do to you. They will turn you away. They will turn you away. That's the first thing he says to them. And what he means by that is, first of all, they'll turn you away from following me, from following God. So remember that our whole kind of theme about Judges is going on a hiking journey to a place we've never really been before. And hopefully we're looking to the person who's been here before and knows where he's going, that being God. We've also talked about Zoe, his breath, his spirit in us, being able to do the directing of our life, of our psuche and our bios, of our physical needs and desires, and our personality, the things that we want to do, the things that we think are right. So idols will, first of all, turn you away from looking to him. Let him lead. You'll stop looking to God for life. For breath. You'll stop asking him for direction. I mean, how many times have someone said, would you do this? And you just immediately said right away, well, sure, I'll do that. Or have you said, well, I need to pray about that. I need to ask God about that. And then, did you? Or did you use that as an excuse? I mean, there's all sorts of ways that we don't look to God and ask Him about what we should be doing. And I do have a story about that. I don't know if I should put it in here now or not. I think I'll save it for a little bit later. So you're not asking God to lead you in all of your life. There isn't this attitude always of looking to God. Well, God, what do you think? And if you stop, if you, oh my, how do I kind of put that? If you're not looking to God for direction, then you are not looking to God for your identity either. You're not looking for your purpose. If I'm not going to look for Him to tell me how to go, then I'm also not going to let Him assign my identity or my purpose. And remember, when He created us, He already assigned our identity. And what is our identity? Image of God. Image of God. That is your identity. If you have any other identity, you are looking away from what God says your identity is. Your identity is image of God. But if I'm not looking for Him to direct me for all the things that I do, say, want, believe, then I'm also not going to let Him say who I am. I will have other images. That's not to say somewhere down the line, I also believe I'm an image of God. But it won't be my image that directs everything. It won't be my identity that directs everything. And we talked about identity, was it last semester that we talked about this so much that we all have all sorts of identities, which are really roles and not identities. But we choose to make them our identity. What would be some of those?
Mother.
Mother, yeah. That's like number one, right, for a lot of us. Mother. What?
Daughter.
Daughter, job, my work. Those are all identities, when in reality, those are roles. Identity is image of God. But as soon as we're not looking for God to lead us, we're also not looking for God to identify us as His image. Therefore, if we're not images of God, that's not our first thought of who we are, we're also losing our purpose. And what is the purpose of an image of God?
To reflect.
To reflect. And how do we reflect? How do we reflect who God is?
By doing what He does.
Which is?
Create.
By
naming,
tending, multiplying for flourishment. Those are what our purpose is. So, to make it really simple, it's always the question of, is this choice reflecting who God is? Is it reflecting His character? Is it reflecting His creative being? Is it naming worth? Is it tending? Is it causing flourishment for myself or others or creation? But that's always the question. But idols will turn us away from asking that question. And we'll ask questions differently. We'll ask questions toward really what we're identifying. We will also, an idol turns us away from God, which means we will also stop participating in cohort. Remember, we talked about God being this Trinitarian relationship, and that's what He's invited us into, this cohort type of a relationship where we each bear the weight and glory of one another. We will not want to participate in that, because it will be uncomfortable. If I'm supposed to be bearing the weight and glory of not only God, but each other person, where does my stuff come in? Right? Where can I do my stuff? Somebody else is supposed to be bearing the weight of that, not me. So there will be all sorts of ways that we will not want to participate in the life of God. So I like the picture of the cohort. For me, that's really vivid. Maybe not for the rest of you. But every Tuesday night, I'm participating in cohort, and it's really vivid, and it's really interesting to watch people begin to bear the weight of another. It's also interesting to watch maybe one or two people not particularly want to be a cohort. You know? You know how that is, right? So we'll do it lots of different ways. And one of the ways is we'll kind of avoid cohort. We might say we're in there. We might say we're in that participating in God's life. But we avoid it by not being vulnerable. So in class, the people who avoid it, what? They don't really share anything, right? Mm-hmm. They'll answer questions if they're asked, but they're not going to share anything. They're not going to. And I have to tell you, most of you know, I'm not one to share a lot unless I'm teaching. That's really easy for me to do it when I'm teaching. But one-on-one, when we're in a group, I'm not going to tell you what's happened. I did that last week. I walked in, I sat next to a girl, and she said, "How was your week?" And I actually told her about my accident, which I normally would not do. But here's the cool thing. This week, I walk in, and the first thing she does is, "I've been thinking about you all week." She was bearing up the weight and glory of me. And it was just this, now we actually have this connection, right? Both of us. Like, she knew something personal about me and how I was struggling with it. And I know that she thought about me all week. So, I mean, this is a woman I don't know. And yet, within cohort, we can do that. I will avoid participation in cohort, though, if I'm not looking for God to give me the breath, for cohort to give me life. I will not do that. I will not be vulnerable. Or maybe another way I'll do it is I'll make my own cohort within the cohort. So I'll kind of like, hey, yeah, right. Well, come on over here, and we'll, and I see that too. We had, for our first time, we had to present our papers last night, and some of the people would say, "Well, now, I talked with that person, and we talked about this," and I'm thinking, why? Why did you do that? Why aren't we all talking about that? But I realized that's kind of our tendency, right? I want to make sure I'm doing okay, so let me get one or two persons over here, and we start making little walls. So, first thing idols will do is turn you away from following God, from looking to Him for life and breath, for looking to Him for identity and purpose. And that is a really big deal, and you're going to see that as we see if they're turning us away from God, then they're also turning us toward themselves. Idols. When we think of idols, we need to think of this, that we're being turned toward an object or an idea. Now, guess what the base word comes from, idea?
Self.
Idol. Oh. Idol. The base word idea is from idol. Interesting, right? Because we really think of ideas as, first of all, probably not bad or good, right? But actually, we think they're a pretty good thing.
Well, I mean, Plato kind of puts it at the top.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, "Oh, you do things, but if you're coming up with ideas."
Right, that's big. And guess where most of our Western philosophy of life comes from? Plato and Socrates. So, idea for us is definitely where we're going to find most of our idols. And we think about an idol turning us away from God and turning us toward an idea or an object, a way of living, that will give us power and control to be able to have our agenda fulfilled, to be able to have our end goal met, whatever our end goal might be. We look to that. And the reason we look to an idea or an object or a way of living is that it gives us a set of things to do in order to get it. What does that sound like?
Transaction,
right? It allows us to enter a transactional paradigm, but it looks good. So I want to think about some of the ideas we might follow as an end goal for our life. Can you think of some ideas that we might follow as, this is what I really want to accomplish in life?
I think of, like,
you know, I want to retire by this age, so I need to save X amount.
Okay. So the idea there would probably be rest, right? Or comfort, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So the idea of rest or comfort, big idea in our culture, right? That would be something that sometimes pulls us to do, to make everything we do get to that goal. So that could become an idol. What would be another idea?
Leaving a legacy.
Leaving a legacy. Okay. So everything I do is toward making sure that I leave some kind of a legacy. Yeah. Heather, do you have one?
Well, I was thinking at any age, young or old, getting married so you can have security.
Okay, perfect. Exactly. Getting married is a big goal for a lot of us, right? So for all of you who aren't married, Taylor's getting married. That might, and here's the thing, right, Taylor? If that had been your goal in life, your whole goal, and next summer you achieve that goal, what happens?
I have nothing to do with the rest of
my life. I'm going to be looking for another goal, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? The thing that Taylor's going to find out that a lot of us already know is, wow, that really wasn't a great goal. And I don't mean that. Obviously, you guys know what I mean. Every one of us who's married, we enter that marriage thinking, this is going to solve all my problems. This is going to make life gorgeous and beautiful. And guess what?
Creates all new problems.
It does.
We will not tell you.
It does. It fits into our battles really well. But it doesn't satisfy who we really are, right?
Well, I mean, kind of right after that one, and something I feel like I hear a lot in Christian radio and church is the idol of family.
Huge.
Like,
huge.
Everything about your family.
Yep.
You should just, like, family, you should have things all over. You should have your focus completely be, and the worship of children.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And kind of
absolutely.
Who they become and what they're going to do. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that kind of thing. And I've
right.
always found that to be kind of messy. Like,
yeah.
I'm hearing it from, like, you know,
yes.
church.
Right.
Christian radio. Like, I'm, like, I don't know.
Right. I think that's very true. So you, everyone knows that, right? I mean, family and children, you know, being the best parent you can be, you know, which is why we've ended up with our helicopter parents and
tiger
moms, yeah. I mean, we've gotten so. I mean, what?
So they keep me in business.
Oh yeah, they do. That's true. She's a therapist. yeah. Actually, Jen, my guess is every one of your clients is dealing with some kind of idolatry.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest one amongst women that I struggle with is the idolatry of the body.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So to have a good looking body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's
stay
definitely.
Young.
Yeah. Stay young.
Young.
So youth. Youth. Yes. Kim. On a day, yes. So let's take that perfection idea and let's put it in the Christian world.
Yep.
What is the idea that every one of us has had as an idol, if not still, in the Christian world? Be a good Christian.
Yes.
Right? Is that not an idea that we have made as an end goal?
You can even envision it.
Absolutely,
like you could create
right.
a statue of it if you wanted to.
Jen, good. That's really
yeah.
good. Because we have in our head, what does a good Christian look like? Right?
Oh, yeah.
And so we actually have things that we mm-hmm. have ideas of what a good Christian is. Jen's right. We could make a statue of it. Now, we don't because that's wrong.
No.
I'm sure there's some
but we definitely do. And we have lots of ways to do it so that it looks like it's okay.
Yeah, we do.
But that, I think that's like probably for us one of the biggest ideas that will turn us toward. And what, and exactly what Jen said, we have an idea exactly of what it's like. So a good Christian, this is what their family looks like. This is what their home looks like. This is what their clothing looks like. This is what they look like.
Their finances.
This is what their finances look like. Their marriage, all their relationships, their neighborhood, and how. Their children. All of this, right? We have all these things. And here's the thing for us: we actually like that because it gives us some very static, concrete. Well, all I need to do is to get those things in line, and I'm a good Christian, right? It gives us control, and that's what an idol does. It gives us control over getting to the end goal.
You know what's interesting is that, like, even Jesus, right? He didn't actually want people to idolize him.
I know.
Kept going, I'm just doing what the Father tells me. You know, he was even modeling, like, even one who could be an idol.
Yes, right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The whole purpose of the incarnation is that he walks with us.
Exactly.
That he is a human,
right?
Both human and divine. So, if you're walking around thinking I'm a perfect Christian, you are actually doing the opposite,
right?
Of what Jesus did.
Exactly.
And most of these things are not attainable, except like getting married. You know, that's going to happen for you. Sorry, I don't know what you're thinking.
Marriage is wonderful, Taylor. But there's always a but, right? Right, exactly. And a perfect marriage is not attainable.
Right.
You know?
Perfection is not.
Right. None of those are attainable. Mm-hmm. And so it makes you need more, right? And more. And look for. Well, maybe if I just did this, I would have the perfect marriage. Or maybe if I just did this. You see what an idol does? It always says, all you need to do is this. A very prescribed, this is what you need to do. In fact, it's how many times do you hear this all the time? If God would just write me a note and tell me exactly what to do, I'd be happy. In other words, if I could just treat God as an idol, I'd be happy. Because idols give me the means, the control, to attain what I need to attain and be who I'm supposed to be.
Or it's like an empty craving.
Yeah. It's completely emptiness. I mean, this is, do you see the futility of it? But do you also see the commonality of it? Of how we are in this?
Jill, I have a question.
Yeah.
The thing about this is that even from a really young age, people attribute these idol-like qualities to Jesus. I was teaching my 7th grade youth ministry last week, and I said, you know, tell me ways which Jesus was just like you. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for things like, he was a baby, he had to wear a diaper, he ate food and drank water, like I was trying to illustrate the point of him being human. And they all were like, well, you know, I'm good all of the time, and I'm kind to all people, and I was like, first of all, that is so untrue. I can't believe this.
You're lying.
Was Jesus a liar? They all looked at me, and I was like, people, he pooped and peed just like you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, he was a person.
Right.
Okay. Yes, he had this divine side, right? But the truth is, and I was trying to kind of hammer home that you don't have to live up. You have to live with.
Right.
And it's amazing to me. And I asked them, how long have you believed this about Jesus? And they all said, as long as I've been alive.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So where the heck does that come from? Because it doesn't come from the Bible. It
comes from culture.
Yeah. So Jill, I have a question. Because I totally understand everything you said and agree with it. But my worlds are blurring here a little bit. Because when I think about like the times that I've been in, you know, deep prayer and trying to understand where God is leading me, lots of times he'll give me an idea that leads to power and control. And so like there's like this like, but I always give it back. Like I always look back for direction.
So that's why we go back to Genesis 1 all the time. What does power and control look like that we are supposed to have. We right. Remember, we're supposed to have power and control.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But not without vulnerability, not without connection. If your power and control is not naming, tending, and multiplying for flourishing, then that's not the power and control God intended for you. And those are the questions you ask. Am I getting power and control here that isn't naming worth in somebody, that isn't tending somebody so that they grow and flourish to who they were meant to be? Is it not for flourishment? And so that's what, those are always the questions you go back to. Okay. Yep, there's a blur. Because we, as human beings, we're made for rule and control with vulnerability. And that's what idols always say. You can have rule and control without vulnerability. You don't have to die to yourself. You don't have to share power. You don't have to let God direct you or other people give you input. It's about you first. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, man, I've got a whole lot of ideas for God.
Right. No. And so here's the thing. But not all ideas are idols.
Right.
But all ideas are very potential idols.
Okay.
Okay? So you always have to go back to that. Is that what's leading me, this idea? Is this idea leading me? Am I doing everything in my life to go toward fulfilling that idea? Or am I looking to God and God says, hey, how about this idea? Oh, okay, God, we'll do that. I'm still looking to him. Is that
yeah.
Okay? All right.
Thank you.
An idol will not only take us, turn us away from letting God lead, turn us toward an object or an idea, to let an idea lead or an object. Object being money or things like that. I think you've probably heard that enough times. That's why I wanted to kind of clear up the idea portion of it. But it will also turn you towards something to identify with. Where do you find your identity? And if you find your identity in being a mom, then maybe there's a little bit of idolatry in there. It's a red flag, if nothing else, if that's where you find your identity. If you find your identity in anything but being the image of God, ooh, we're sliding into a really rough area there. Very close, if not already, into idolatry. And that's hard to say to you, right? Because every one of us is there. Right? Hopefully in Judges you're going to see that, yeah, we're all idolaters. And it's not about, okay, so if I just don't do this, I won't be an idolater. Right? That's hopefully you don't walk away from Judges going, well, I just need to not do these things and then I'm good. Because then you just got the opposite idea and then you went back to idolatry again. An idol will also help you hide from vulnerability. It will keep you from vulnerability because you'll be satisfying your needs. You'll be making sure that you're comfortable or safe or respected or good looking, whatever it is that your need is, you're satisfying that. And when you satisfy your own need, you necessarily aren't connecting with others. So an idol helps you hide from vulnerability, which is exactly what happens right in Genesis 2 or Genesis 3, right? We have Adam and Eve hiding their vulnerability. They don't want to connect with God now. They have an idol, and we can go through even the idol of leaves and all of that, but we'll leave that for another day. What I want us to think about is the fact that we are made as images means we were made to be reflective. So every one of us is reflective. That's our nature. Our nature is reflective, as if we are the moon, right? It has no light of its own. It's reflective. We are made reflective. That's who we are, reflective. So what I want you to think about, and I'm going to give a couple of you these, and then the rest of you, I want you to think about as if, Annie, would you wear this, please? See if we can get Kelly, did you wear that?
Yes.
Oh, Donna, did you wear that? I want you to think of this as if you walked around every day with a mirror. And when people saw you, they saw it was in your mirror. So whatever you're walking toward, that day, that's who they see you as. And if every day you're walking toward making sure you look good, so in other words, you're exercising 3 times a day, you're not eating, or you're eating in ways that God never intended us to eat, that's what they see. They see an image of a good-looking person. And that may be actually what we want them to see. But it's not who we are. We're images of God. And what they should be seeing is God. And they should be seeing God's character. They should be seeing someone who names worth and tends others and multiplies for others flourishing. That's what God says. If you're looking to me, then that's what's being reflected out. So, I don't know how many people we have. I'm thinking about all these mirrors, and I knew I had these mirrors somewhere. Long story, but God was amazing to actually help me find these. I want you to put these mirrors in your name tag. And I want you to be thinking about that throughout the day of, I'm reflecting whatever I'm going toward. So go ahead and put those in.
Can you tell us how you found them?
Oh. No, it's not worth it. So I'm going to put this on so you're reminded too. That's the idea here that we're getting at. All this before we even get into the chapter. So God says, they will turn you away. And if I'm reflective, then they're going to turn me towards something else. And it doesn't matter how little the turn is, right? He said, do not turn to the left or the right. That turn is going to mean you're reflecting something else. And that's what you're showing God, showing the world. And if our whole point of being priest is to bring people near to God, we're not doing that if we're turned to the left or the right, right? So, if idols turn you away from God and turn you toward a different end goal, and by the way, when we think about this, I want you to think about this. What is your end goal in life? What is it that you really want to accomplish in your life?
Good and faithful servant from God.
Good and faithful servant from God. And that would be image of God, right? Definitely. Now step it back. What is your end goal for this season in your life? Step it back one more time. What's your end goal for today? What do you want to accomplish today? Honestly, do you have something specific you want to accomplish? Because that's what you're going to be walking toward.
I have a big
You have a big list, which most of us do, right? And so most of us have an end goal of being accomplished. That's an idea, right? Of getting done all of our things. But tomorrow morning, we have a whole other list, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the switch. If my end goal today is to be the image of God, is to name worth, and tend and flourish, if that's my end goal, do you think my day is going to look different? Do you think when I don't accomplish all the things that were on my list, that I'll be frustrated at the end of the day if I actually named somebody's worth? If my end goal is actually to be image, I'll be thrilled. The fact that I didn't get my stuff done or that stuff went wrong will not be as big of a deal. Do you see the different switch there?
And you don't hit burnout.
And you don't hit burnout. You absolutely don't hit burnout. Right? Mm-hmm. Heather.
I hesitate to ask because I hope it hasn't already been covered fully, but can you clarify more tending?
Tending. It means to, yeah. So last semester, we actually physically gave each other plants that we had to tend. So what do you have to do to tend a plant, especially if it's somebody else's?
Water it, put it in the sun.
Yeah. Give it everything it needs to grow, right? So tending others means to give them the things they need to grow into an image of God. So, I mean, that opens up, you know, all sorts of ways. And remember, because image of God is a relationship, it's not a list of things. I can't give you a list. Well, here are the things you need to do to tend people, right? It's relationship. I've talked about this before. We don't tend one another in all the same ways, right? I'm not going to tend to my daughter as I tend to my son. If I tend to them equally, I've just made them a commodity rather than individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So, does that a little bit illuminate that? Okay.
Hey, Jill.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm wondering, too, when you said we'll reflect what we're walking towards, because mm-hmm. for me, like, you've named 10, I think I can probably name people's worth and tend them and multiply for flourishing and make that an idol, that idea. But when you said, what am I walking towards? Mm-hmm. If I am walking, I'll reflect that. If I'm walking towards God,
yep.
for me, it's just yep. where I was at, I was like, oh, that's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, there's no way
right.
I can idol walking towards God.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you brought up a key point. If I use that rubric, I will make that an idol. And I will strive then to name, right? How can I name this person? How can I name this person? Right? So, good point. It is walking toward God because when I'm walking to God, hey, God, what would you like me to do? Remember we talked about that Trinitarian communication, that we're always in conversation with him, mm-hmm. so that when I'm with him, I'm looking to him to say what to, and he'll bring me to naming and tending. The naming and tending will become, oh, I actually got to name Worth today. So it's almost a surprise for us, right?
Right? He's gonna
right exactly.
It's gonna reflect yep. because it's him.
Exactly, exactly. So very good point. So even, and that's what I mean by good Christian being that idea of an idol. Really, even that rubric of naming, tending, and flourishing. It's a good test at the end of the day to go, did I name or tend or multiply to flourishing today? Maybe not. Did I force it? Maybe. Was I walking toward God? Was I always in conversation with God? Was I connected with God, letting him direct that? If he's directing it, you will be doing those things. So very good point, Melissa. Really good.
And also, it's more of it comes through you than from you.
Exactly. Absolutely. That's what happens is with following God, looking at. Hopefully, as we get into Judges, we'll actually see some more of that, where we do it and where we don't do it, and what that looks like. Also, an idol will snare you, God says. God tells them, the reason I don't want you to follow idols is not only that they'll take you away from following me, and you'll be following something else that won't reflect who you are, let alone who I am, but they'll also snare you. So that picture of snare, everyone knows what a trap looks like, right? Like a metal trap. Even us city people know what a metal trap looks like, thanks to what Wiley, Kaiko, Odie, and such things. But it is a noose or a jaw to trap an animal. So already it's bringing us down to a place that we aren't. And it keeps you in a confined space, right? I mean, how many of you have caught a mouse in your house? In the thing, right?
Yes. Oh,
yeah. It makes sure, even if it keeps the mouse alive, it keeps them right there, right? They can't go anywhere else. They're there. They're in
sticky traps. They can take those away.
That's true.
You're running from under.
That's not the kind of trap he's talking about here. You will see, and we've seen this. You will see a mouse nibble his leg off. To get out of that. That's happened in our house. That may happen because we were not made to be confined to a space. We were not made to be in a small space. God always, in his delivering, always puts us in a wide open space for choice because we are made in his image. So when I'm following an idol, it doesn't give you space. It says, here's what you need to do to be accepted, to be a good mother, to be a good Christian, to be whatever it is, that idea that you're going toward, it gives you the rubric right here, and you fall out of that rubric and you're not going to be that, right? So you see that it puts you in a very confined space. It will starve you of nourishment, right? If that mouse is in the trap, that mouse isn't going to eat. He might eat at the beginning. In fact, that's might have what brought him to that trap, right? He might have seen the peanut butter or the cheese or whatever it is. But he won't be getting any more of that. And it will only make you useful to the culture that said traps are good, that said idols are good. It'll make you useful in some way or not. And some of these I'm not going to delve into too much because I want you to be able to see them as we get through the passages. So God says one more thing. Not only will they turn you away and turn you toward, not only will they be a snare, but they'll also be thorns in your side. The word thorns there actually means to be, to breathe. It's actually the same word they use for God, to be, but to be on a side or to be adversarial. So thorns will breathe adversity. They'll breathe againstness. We're going to make up some words here. Againstness. And we've talked about this a lot, right? Mm-hmm. That God has not called us to be against, but to be for. And they will, idols always will make sides. So if my idea, my idol, is to be a good Christian, I have this list of what it is to be a good Christian. And if I see anybody outside of that list, what do I do? You're not a good Christian. I judge. And as soon as I do that, I've made a wall between us. You are them and I'm us. Right? There's an us and them idea here. So as soon as you begin to be in that little confined space where this is what a good Christian looks like, you will be an adversary. And you will live in this adversarial moment all the time. And you will find yourself judging all the time. Here's my problem for me, judging, and this is just so silly, but I have this box of what does a good home look like? Not inside, but outside. So I take walks, and literally, I go, they really should have put that over there. Oh, they really should put geraniums here. Every time I take a walk, and I have to stop myself and think, what are you doing? I'm literally deciding what's right for them. Because what's right in my eyes, right? So anytime I'm doing that, I know that there's some idolatry at work there.
And you have gifts and talents in that area.
Right. Okay. And we're going to get to that, right? Okay. And I'll tell you a little story about that. So I used to do that. I used to, for hire, tell people what they needed to do with their yards. And I had one person refuse to do what I told her to do.
Uh-oh. She didn't really want
it. I'm done. I'm done. None of my things will work if you won't do that. So, obviously a problem with idolatry here, right?
And those gifts and talents are in you from God, which is interesting.
Right, right. So we're gonna look at that as we look at the judges as well. So creativity and words are my gift, and they are also the place where I will find myself falling into idolatry.
Which is how we all are, right?
Which is how we all are. Right. Yeah, all are. So the thorns will actively fight against your flourishing as well as anybody else's flourishing. So idolatry always is about you satisfying your end goal. And if it's about you satisfying your end goal, then everybody else, watch out. Now, of course, we would never put it in those terms. We would say, oh, I won't step over people to get what I want. But come up against what you want, and you're going to find you that you do. Kim?
I was just thinking that too has another perspective, because the against word sounds so negative. advocating for others. So they're against oppression, but for people, for community, for thriving.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where, you know, there's that balance as you look at your faith through the sieve of how do you want to reflect God.
Right.
But that is, that moves you and has the ability to frame your next steps.
Yep. And I would give a caveat to that. If the against the injustice is the big thing rather than the for the people, then it's an idol. So I can be against, like what are some of the big things that we're against? Abortion. Okay. If that is my driving force, what happens?
You drive a wall.
I just put a wall. Against always puts a wall. It's, am I for all people? Right? And that's where we lose all the fights. Because we say we're against. And God does not say that. It is not what he is. When he creates, he doesn't say, I'm against. I'm for. Here's what I'm for. And then he gives people the choice. Well, you don't want to be for? Okay. Then you're going to live in an adversarial. And we have put ourselves as Christians in adversarial positions because we've idolized ideas rather than connected with people.
And to your point there, the emphasis should always be, you know, the two greatest commandments are love God and love others.
Yep.
Then always that is the benchmark.
Always.
It's people always first.
Right.
So it's,
right.
And that's where I was, you know, when you talk about prophets and people.
Yep.
It's reversed. Prophets aren't bad.
Right.
It's that are sacrificing people.
Right. So always driving force, idols, when we think about that. What's our driving force? What are we trying to get? And if, let's say even in the abortion issue, if I'm trying to get abortion to be illegal, that's what I'm going toward, I am missing out on all the people, right? So even things that sound good, in fact, almost all the time, things that sound good are the places that we start idolizing. Mm-hmm. Which is why I said, even the Israelites really didn't see their idolatry as a bad thing. Because they were good things. They were trying to get along with their neighbors or whatever. So the idea of ideas. What will God do with idols? And really what he does is, he doesn't necessarily deal with the idols themselves. He deals with the culture that supports the idols. So, and this is very important for us to understand that there is always a culture behind the idols. There's a culture that's supporting the idols. That's where we get wrapped up in. And this is what God says. What is he going to do to the nations that support and sustain idols? First of all, he says he's going to leave them to test them. To test whether they will, I think the word in there is obey. No such word. Just so you know, Hebrew does not have a word for obey. The word is listen. The word is listen. And that's really key. Because for us, when we as North American Christians hear obey, we think do, right? Just do this on the list and I'm good. There is no word. For the Hebrews, it's listen. Because that means you got to connect. You got to connect with God. So, he's going to lead them to test for their listening. And the test here is always a proving or a refining. So I know all of you know this, but it's still the best picture that we have. And that is the refining of silver. So you know that silver is refined of all, you know, silver is not found pure. You dig it out of the ground, out of the earth, and it has all sorts of other minerals and things in silver. So in order to make the silver pure, you have to get rid of the impurities. And you can't dig out the impurities. You have to burn them. You have to heat it up. So for silver, you heat it up to a certain degree, put a lot of fire to it, and some of those impurities start coming up at the top, and now you can skim them off. What is the goal of purifying silver?
To see the reflection of the artist or
creator.
Yes,
exactly. So a silversmith knows that the silver is completely pure when he's able to see his reflection in the silver. Sound familiar? What's on the back of mirrors?
Reflection.
coating that's on the back of these.
Guess what that is? Silver. Originally. Yeah. Now we've made up our own silver, but that's what makes a mirror reflective. A mirror is just glass with a backing of silver on it. That's where you're getting the reflection. That's who we are. So God says, I'm going to leave the nations who are supporting idolatry to test you, to prove you, to get out your impurities. All those other voices that you're hearing and all that clamoring to give you the choice to get rid of those. And I'm also going to use them to teach you war. I want you to know war. Number one, because I want you to experience my work and my presence. And we experience his work and his presence mostly when we're in distress. Would you not agree?
Yeah.
Yep. He knows it. And so he's going to teach us war. He's going to bring us into war so that we experience his presence and his work. He's always there working, and he's always there, but viscerally, we feel it most when we're in distress. He also wants to teach us war so that we learn not to fear, so that we aren't afraid that we are in the midst among all these peoples who have gods, and that we're not afraid of war with them. You know, we have a whole book before Judges of Joshua where the people just, all right, we got a battle, we're going to battle. We're going to get rid of this culture that supports idolatry. We're going to do this. And now we have a whole generation that's afraid to do this. That they're afraid to have a battle with the culture because, oh, that's too scary. God wants to make sure that they have experience in battle, that they realize coming out of it, wow, it was scary, but God was with me. And what came out of it is I'm shinier. I'm more reflective. The worst battles that I've ever gone through have been the best thing for my shininess. There's no way I could have. And some of us joke that, you know, the more, how should I put this? Not stubborn. The stronger you are, the more war you need, right? The stronger the battle, the more fire that needs to come out. But you come out of those and you realize, wow, I'm not going to choose to run into a battle, but I'm not going to be so afraid. I know the good that comes out of it, and I know that God's with me in it. So he wants us to be able to experience that. He also wants us to learn how to possess everything he has for us. He wants us not to be content, not to be those people on the shore. I can play in the mud here instead of in the ocean. He doesn't want us to be satisfied with a little when he has a lot to give us. He has an abundant life to give us, and we're satisfied with an okay life.
Complacency.
He never wants us to be complacent. So that's what God is going to do with the cultures that support idolatry. So understanding idols, now let's understand Israel, where we're going in here. We have in the chapter 3, we're starting with verse 5 there. We've just gone through the first four verses. That the sons of Israel lived among all of these, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Just as an aside, whenever you see Canaanites, that incorporates lots of different people, okay? Because it's the land of Canaan. So Canaanites can be a specific people, and they can be also the term for the general people, the general people that aren't following God within that land. Just so if you're trying to match things up, you're like, it doesn't make sense. And they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their own daughters to their sons. So the first thing we need to understand about Israel is that they are making covenants. What had God told them before they came in?
Do not intermarry
with them. make no covenants. And here's the thing you need to understand. The covenant that God made with Israel at Sinai was a marriage covenant. When you read the whole section of Sinai, that reads exactly like a marriage covenant. Not a Christian or Jewish marriage covenant, a marriage covenant from the ancient people. That's what it looked like. It was a marriage covenant. And in that marriage covenant, he gave them, he said, it's going to be hard for you to be faithful. Here are some ways that will help you remain faithful to me. And so he gives them the 10 words. Here's ways that are going to help you to be faithful to me, to keep your eyes on me. And the first thing that I'm going to do is give you a rhythm, right? I'm going to give you that Sabbath rhythm. And that Sabbath rhythm will always give that little interruption to your agenda. Because, and we always misinterpret what Sabbath means. We always think that Sabbath means no work. That's kind of how we. But if you read more closely, and especially in the prophets, Sabbath means don't do what delights you. Don't do your agenda. So a lot of times we use Sabbath and we go, well, I'm not supposed to work, so I'm going to play. So I'm going to do what I love to do. That may happen on a Sabbath, but the whole point of Sabbath is for you to remember and reconnect with God and people. He gives that so that your agenda stops for a week, for a day. And it's like all of a sudden, oh, it's not about me getting all this done here. So work becomes the big thing. It's not about me getting my needs met here. I'm going to stop that for a minute and realize it's not about that. And every one of the other commandments, all the other 9 commandments, are toward looking out for others, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking out for the parents or for people who have stuff that you don't have or for people who that you want that aren't yours. All of the other commandments are making sure that you're looking to him for your needs to be met and not you going there. They're just like, yeah, if you stay that way, you're gonna be looking at me. So in his marriage covenant to them, he gives them ways to help them be faithful. And he says, so don't make a covenant with other people. Maida?
Is it possible for you to maybe relate this to like our culture now of, you know, soccer games are on Sundays and just, you know, the typical Sabbath, the way I grew up with it looks so different now. And it kind of causes a battle in my heart and my mind. Am I doing this? Am I messing this up?
Yeah. You know, I'm gonna put that off until another lesson because I know that there's gonna be a lesson more on Sabbath. Remember that Jesus says Sabbath is made for man and man not for Sabbath. So again, I'm not gonna give you a list of rules of what your Sabbath is gonna look like, right? Because then what did I do? I just gave you an idol. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've been, right? And we swing the pendulum from either an idolatry of this is what Sabbath looks like to an idolatry I don't have to keep Sabbath. And neither are correct. So we will address that in some lessons to come. So he says, make no covenants with anybody else. And a covenant is an agreement. Don't make agreements with anyone else, with anything else. Because when I make an agreement, I put my life into theirs. I become one with that agreement. And then that becomes what I walk toward. The way of life of idols is a transactional paradigm. Don't make an agreement to have a transactional life because it becomes such a part of you that, number one, it's very hard for you to see it anymore. And number two, it's very hard for you to separate because now it's going to be a big loss, like a divorce. So he says, make no agreements. And this is where I'm going to bring us back to our maps. That one page on determinations and decisions, those are agreements. And I've shared with you one of mine from my young life. I will never let anyone build my expectations up too much. And there's always a so that, right? In order that I get. so that I'm not disappointed. That's an idol. I will never allow my expectations to get so high so that I'm not disappointed. I am making sure that my need to not be disappointed is protected. That's an idol. Because now, when I've made that agreement with my little 10-year-old self, now I'm always kind of going toward that. Oh, you tell me it's going to be really great inside, I'm like pulling it back, like, yeah, it'll be nice. It won't be great. Because I don't want to get there and be disappointed. Do you see what I've done? Now, wherever I go, whatever I do, I'm making sure that that one determination I've made is going to be fulfilled so that I don't get disappointed. What that says, number one, is I can meet my own needs. I can achieve that. I can make sure that I'm not disappointed. Is it true? Mm-hmm. Number two, it says my covenant partner can't meet that need. I'm saying God can't meet that need, but I can. Heather.
So then conversely, what does that look like if it's not an idol, if it's not, like, if they're, for that specific example? Mm-hmm.
First of all, I don't make that agreement with myself, right? I don't say, I will never, or I will always, right? I allow God to bring whatever it is, and I say, whatever you bring, God, I know you've determined is good. Will I be disappointed sometimes? Yeah, of course, because we're human, right? And we don't see everything as good that God brings us, right? We're not happy. I'm not happy that I got into an accident last week. Do I believe that God has something in me that for me? Yep. And can I be honest with God and say I'm disappointed? Yep. But even if I would have said, I'm not going to do... here's the temptation for me to go, I will never disobey that law again, right? I will never get in the right of way. And what have I already done? I'm sitting... No, I haven't done that. I'm not going past the white line. But I watch other people do it, and I say... Yeah, that's what happens. But if I make an agreement and say, I will never do that again so that I never get into another accident, I'm starting toward that. This is what I'm going to make sure that I never get into an accident. But does it mean I'm not going to get into an accident? No, it doesn't. I could be sitting there and doing nothing and still get into an accident. I could be sitting in my driveway and still get into an accident. It is me trying to control. That's the issue. Me trying to control instead of allowing God to bring me stuff and to receive it as a gift. So, I mean, we did a whole semester on that, right? Receiving everything as a gift. All the bad stuff that's happened to you this week, gift. Does that give you a little idea?
I think it goes against that culture of you do the right thing, you're going to get blessing. Mm-hmm. And if you, yep. Obviously, you're screwing up somewhere.
Right.
And
right.
That's why the heat is coming on. It's right. Not, it's a punishment.
Right, exactly.
It's a loving sort of
right.
The thing to
right.
Bring God more glory, to produce more flourishing.
Yep, yep.
And we were like, oh, we don't do that. Oh, yeah, we do.
Yeah, we do. And everybody knows who's been in a situation where things have just fallen apart. And you know, number one, that people are judging you, mm-hmm. Right? And you know that you've said, well, God, I did everything right. I mean, I've said it to God very loudly. God, I did everything right. I told you, did everything you told me to do. And he said, oh, I know. What can he say? So he says, don't make covenants. Don't make agreements with the culture of idols. So when it says in Judges 3 that they are marrying, they're taking the daughters as wives for themselves and giving their daughters also to, they are making agreements with the culture of transactional living. And he says in making agreements, you're marrying, becoming one with transactional life. You're also serving the gods. You're doing whatever it takes to support that way of life. Even if they say, but I don't believe that. This is just what you need to do to survive in that culture, right? I mean, we do this all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that that's a good way to live, but you know, you got to do it, right? You got to. I mean, we do it all the time, right? We don't believe we should be in debt, but you got to do that in this culture, right? That's how this culture works. So, whatever. I'm not saying that that's wrong or right. I'm just saying we always do this all the time. And this is what I mean by Israel didn't really think that they were bowing down to the idols. They're just surviving in that culture. And now do you see why God says get rid of the culture? Because we feel like we've got to survive here somehow. So God says, yeah, see, it's a snare to you. Now you're in this small space, and you feel you got to survive in that small space. And so you're going to compromise. Mm-hmm. And you're going to begin to serve those gods and do whatever it takes to support that way of life.
Does a culture, and I just see this sometimes, it takes away our choice. Does yes. God always give us a choice,
yep.
right?
Yep.
So when we feel like we don't have a choice, mm-hmm. that's a culture
yep.
getting mm-hmm. us
right.
to...
Yep. Exactly.
You got no choice.
Right.
You see it all the time.
All the time. All the time. And the funny thing is, our culture also then idolizes choice. Right? Mm-hmm. Isn't yes. that funny? Yep. We're not going to give you choice, but we're going to idolize choice as something you should go toward.
Right. That's really taken away.
Yeah. So an interesting paradigm, of course. Mm-hmm. Again, remembering that idols always lie. They always say, you get control and power, and you don't have to be vulnerable. That's a lie. But it's very tempting for every one of us. So, understanding Israel, they made covenants, agreements. They did evil. Remembering that evil, that word evil, bring it down, it means of inferior quality. It means they were not being image bearers. They didn't want to live as image bearers and have that as their identity. They didn't want to be naming and tending and flourishing. They didn't want to be looking to God for identity. They were choosing to live inferior lives of inferior quality. And when we follow idols, whatever it might be, Isaiah talks about this a lot, saying that idols have no eyes to see and no ears to hear and no mouth to speak. We reflect what we're going toward, right? We reflect the idols who have no way to give us direction. They have no way to see what's going on in our lives. And yet we carry them with us. How can I put that? When I'm an image of God, I'm reflecting God, right? His character, his creation, how he creates. When I am not reflecting God, I'm reflecting the absence of God. And when I reflect the absence of God, it's really easy to find out whether I'm doing that or not. Because I can say, am I merciful? Am I loving my neighbor in this choice? Am I, beside naming and tending and flourishing, is God's character being seen here or not? Because when I'm following an idol, I am reflecting the absence of God. Just like when I'm turning away from the light, I'm reflecting darkness, the absence of light, right? There's only one thing to really reflect, and that is God and his light. Or I reflect the absence of that. So that when I am not being loving, when I am being self-centered, when I am going toward my own stuff, I can be pretty sure that I'm trying to follow an idol somewhere. So doing evil is choosing to live an inferior life, a life of inferior quality, reflecting not the God who made us, but reflecting the absence of him. They also were sending tribute to their oppressor. You know what tribute is, right? It's like taxes. It's kind of like an appeasement. You know, here's money. You know, be okay to us. So what that means is that I begin to use what I've been given by the Creator to make sure that my idol stays there. Instead of, everything I've been given was, why did God give me anything? Why did he give me any gifts? Why does he give Israel any gifts? What are they supposed to do with it? Give it to others, right? I mean, it's over and over and over again. Deuteronomy is full of this. You've been given wealth to share it with others. You've been given whatever your gifts are to share it with others. What happened with an idol for them is that they actually paid tribute. They gave the gifts that God had given them to the culture that's supporting idol bearers. We give our gifts to support our idols so that we use what we've been given, whether it's money or time or talents or abilities. We use that to go toward our idol. So if I'm using my gift, if I use my gift of teaching, I might be teaching you great, wonderful things from God, but if I'm using it for the purpose of building myself up, that's what I just did. Mm-hmm. I gave tribute to my oppressor. If I use my gifts to build myself up, to make myself either comfortable or respected or safe, if that's what I'm using my gifts for, then I'm using them to build up the oppressor, to build up idolatry in my life. Does this make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thought this was a short chapter. I'm thinking we're never going to get there. Forgetting God as Lord. This is the third thing they did, is they forgot God. Interesting, in our verse, it says forsake. Where do you hear the word forsake ever? Where do you ever use the word forsake? That's the only time we use it, right? It's a wedding. When I forget God, I forget my husband. I forget who is loving me and supporting me. And this is what Israel was doing. They were forgetting him and turning away. They weren't looking. They weren't listening. For us, not letting his breath be the driving force for my psuche and my bios, that's forgetting God. And turning toward, of course, the idol, what will build up your broken self, or at least promise to build up your broken self, build up your psuche and your bios. And the fourth thing he says they do then is cry. So they cry, and that is a shriek of anguish. And all I could think of was, if we're wearing these mirrors all day long, and all of a sudden we look into the mirror and we see what we've been following, ah! Right? That's kind of the same idea here, is all of a sudden it got bad enough for them to see, oh my gosh, that's horrible. Just enough. That's all God wants. One little inkling of, I can't do this. This is not giving me life. I need help. That one indication that maybe I know that this isn't giving me life. And it, as in the case of Israel and mostly in the case of us, it's very temporary for them. It's, well, at this moment it's not giving me life. Maybe I just didn't do it right, but right now it's not giving me life, right? Just for this moment. I may go back to it and try again. Maybe I just didn't do it in the right sequence. But for that moment, this is what God is waiting for. All he wants is to know we want to reconnect with him, that we want to look back to him. And so that help is a reorienting of our sight. It's like, oh, it's like, right, a little kid, a two-year-old, wants to do what he wants to do, wants to do, wants to do. And when it fails, what is the first thing he does?
Cries.
And he looks, right? He looks to mom. That's what God's looking for. Just look back here. Look back here. And so that's what we see Israel doing. So that's understanding kind of what Israel is doing in here. Now what we need to do is understand the nations. Because the nations are the culture that are supporting the idols, but also this is what Israel is reflecting. So when we look in Judges at all the enemies, that's what Israel is reflecting. That's what they're living. So don't look at this as if they're here and Israel's here. Yeah, they're here and Israel's here, and they're facing each other, and Israel's reflecting that. So this is why we really need to understand the nations in each of these, because it's what Israel is reflecting. It's what they're going toward. It's the culture that they're assimilating with and have married into and are becoming. So that gives us an idea of what they've slid into, what kind of a transactional world they've slid into. That's what they're doing. So what the nation is doing, that's what Israel's doing. So let's look at the nations that in Judges 3. Judges 3 talks about three different nations. First nation is Mesopotamia, and the king is Cushan-Rishathaim. And some of this stuff you won't get unless you're reading Hebrew. There's a lot of play on words here, and so there's some play on words with his name and where he comes from, but it's not worth going into the Hebrew for that. Mesopotamia. Let's first talk about Mesopotamia. These are what we know. And all I'm going to do is give you little slivers of what we know from Scripture as opposed to what we know outside sources and things. But there's a lot we could go into. So this is what we know from Scripture. Mesopotamia is where Abram came from. It's where he was called out of. And they were a pagan nation. Remember, if we go all the way back into Genesis. They were a nation who sacrificed people. So their religious rites were all about sacrificing people, literally, putting them on the altars and burning them to death, mostly children. But that's kind of the religion of Mesopotamia. And Abraham is called out of that. So this is one of the oppressors. The only other thing we really know about Mesopotamia is, anybody remember Balaam? Okay, so Balaam is from Mesopotamia. Balaam was a prophet, probably one of the funniest stories, I think, in the Bible. But he was a prophet who was called to come prophesy against Israel. And it was Moab that actually comes and calls him from Mesopotamia to come prophesy against Israel. He is a prophet of God, the Most High God, Israel's God. And yet he entertains this request from the king of Moab. So Balaam entertains, and this is where Kim brought this before, is he entertains using his gift for profit. Oh, they're going to pay me. Okay, let's see what they got to say. And so he goes through lots of debates with the king of Moab until the one point where he's going back to see if he can prophesy for them against Israel. This is the story of Balaam and his donkey, right? And his donkey won't go ahead, and his donkey starts talking to him. And Balaam yells at his donkey, "What do you think you're doing? You, my own donkey, who I have loved and tended and cared for, and you're going to speak against me?" What's happening? Balaam is prophesying to himself. He is God's, and he's going to speak against God? What we get from the story of Balaam, and why I bring it up in respect to Mesopotamia, is it is a mocking of God to use your gift for profit. It's a mocking of God, which is exactly what happens here with the donkey speaking to Balaam. That's what Balaam is doing to God. He says to the donkey, "You're mocking me." And God's saying to Balaam, "You're mocking me by using your gift for profit." By not just, and here's the thing, Balaam doesn't end up doing it. He actually prophesies what God says rather than what Moab wants. But he was led by that prophet, right? "They're going to pay me. I got this gift." Yeah. So you see the where the mocking comes in.
Still, it's not so much about the pay as it is about going against God, right? Because some of us get paid to be in ministry.
Right. But is that your motive? Okay. So that's, okay. And that was his motive here.
That's why I don't get paid much.
Right, right, exactly. But and ministry is a place where it's very easy to go off in another direction. You're in ministry for what reason?
Okay.
You know, having been there,
yeah.
You know, I've seen it all. Mm-hmm. So actually it is his motive is I get paid for what I'm good at, what I do. So I'm going to go toward that. Oh, I'll say what God wants, but and that's, he does that, right? He couches in, well, I'm just going to say what God says. But the fact that he does it for profit,
right?
Okay, he's doing it for himself,
motive.
Right? His motive is to build himself up, profit. So that kind of gives you a little background of the people of Mesopotamia, what Mesopotamia looks like. And the only thing we know, yeah, that window is really hard to open. You can, that window will be better.
Sorry, I just thought it was good.
I agree. Cushan Rishathaim. The name means, you just got it really hard. Yeah. It means double wickedness. So, when we're looking at the king of Mesopotamia and we're looking at Mesopotamia, these are the things that they're being under bondage to. And why are they under bondage? Because it's where they were going. It's what they were doing. They assimilated into this culture of mocking God, of using their gifts for profit, for themselves, to build themselves up. That's what the culture was about. I will use my talents and abilities to build myself up, to get what I want, to get my end goal. That's what that nation looks like, but that's what Israel is looking like. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's Mesopotamia and Cushan. Moab and Eglon spend a lot of time here. Anytime, particularly in this Judges 3, the narrator is telling a story. Anytime the story all of a sudden gets a lot of reality there, a lot of space in there, the story slowed down. That means this is a big piece here. This is really the essence of the first and the last nations and idolatry here. So we look at Moab and Eglon. Moab, first of all, from Judges 3. Judges 3:29 says what? Somebody read that.
They struck down at that time about 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men, and no one escaped.
Okay, so how are the Moabites described?
Robust and valiant.
Robust and valiant. Valiant is not the valiant of we are strong and mighty. It actually means mighty in wealth. So they're very wealthy. Robust means something like dripping in grease. It actually means so fat, so full of themselves, so both this robust and valiant is this idea of a culture who is all about satisfying themselves. So that's what we get from looking at that. That's why it's so important when we look up at words. Oh, this just doesn't mean that. I mean, we look at that robust and valiant like, you know, great warriors. That's not what they're talking about. This is an army full of fat, greasy men. I mean, that's kind of the picture that it wants. Remember also. Yeah, I know. But remember that this was always first an oral tradition. And particularly in the Old Testament, being oral tradition, it tells the story in ways you're going to remember things that are important. So when it says they struck down the fat, greasy men, that's purposeful, right? Oh, I'm going to remember that Moab was fat and greasy. And this is what Israel was married to, being the same. So what are the origins of Moab? Anybody know without looking on your paper? Where did Moab come from? Anybody know?
Lot.
Yeah, from Lot.
No.
How?
His daughter,
two of them, one said, there are no men around. After the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, there are no men around. We need to get, well, so what was their big thing?
Have a baby,
right? All Israelites believed having a baby was number one. And we could talk about that because that's a strength throughout. That was the most important thing. There's no women around or men around. How are we going to do this? We're going to need to get it for ourselves, right? and the only man around is dad.
Yeah.
So one daughter goes into Lot. From that incest, there's a baby, and his name is Moab. So think about this. There's a reason God puts all of these things in, so you understand the culture that they're assimilating into. The culture comes from an incestuous relationship because they wanted to get what they want. They wanted their needs satisfied by themselves. Their allies, we see here in, is it 29? No. That the king of Moab, oh, in 13, gathers to himself the sons of Ammon and Amalek. Origin of Ammon? The other daughter for Lot does the exact same thing. They actually form their own little cohort and say, hey, we need to get dad for both of us. They satisfy their need, and it seems to work, right? But what happens down the line? They become severe enemies of Israel. So that's where Ammon and Moab come from. Amalek. Amalek is a very warlike tribe, and we see that when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were the army that took advantage of all the weaklings at the end of the line. And they took advantage of the ones that couldn't defend themselves, and they killed the children and the weak women and the people behind the line. Esau's son or grandson was named Amalek. There is debate whether that's the same Amalek. So that's why I put that possibly Esau's son or grandson. I tend to think it's not, but that is a possibility. So these are the allies of Moab. So are we getting a picture of what Moab looks like? Mm-hmm. Remember, when you get a picture of the enemy, you're getting a picture of Israel. This is what they're going toward. And of course, it's very slight, as here, right? As our own culture, we do the same thing. We start mixing into the culture, and now it's kind of fuzzy as to where we're doing the same kinds of things. So what are the actions of Moab just within these this chapter? First of all, they attacked in 13. They attacked and gained possession of what? The city of palm trees. Anybody know what that is? City of Palms is Jericho. I forgot to put the verse down where you know where you find that. I didn't make that up or look it up somewhere. Yeah, that's where it says the City of Palms. But the City of Palms is Jericho. I want you to think about that. The Moabites own Jericho. What was Jericho? Yeah, the people's first conquest, right? And how did they conquer Jericho?
Marching
God. Yeah, why did they do that again?
That's what God
said. Ah, this is the first place we see them listening to God in all the ridiculous directions he gave, and they did it, right? I mean, it's the goofiest story, and they listened. But who owns that now?
Moab.
It's like they have just mocked and said to Israel, well, you used to listen to God, but obviously you don't anymore since we own it. Do you see what's happening here? What's happening is God is showing us where Israel is. They are no longer listening to God's directions because Moab now built up Jericho again. So we have them, the fact that they possess the City of Palms. So they're mocking not only God's victory there, but the Israelites' obedience and listening to God. And then we have in 19 the fact that there are idols at Gilgal. That should be a big, like, what? Red flag. There are idols at Gilgal? We talked about Gilgal last week. What is Gilgal? Right. It's where God rolled away the reproach. And now there's idols? Again, another mockery of what God has done. And a mockery, what else is at Gilgal? The 12 stones. This is where they crossed the Jordan. They took the 12 stones from the Jordan, set them up as a memorial to do what?
Pass on their stories.
To tell their stories. And now, this is where the idols are. And this tells us again what's happening to Israel. We're not telling the stories. We don't even own that land where we can go back and go, see, son, this is what God did, and I can tell you my stories. No, we've allowed that to be a place where idols are constructed. So everything we know about the enemy tells us what's happening with Israel, what's going on with Israel. So a mockery to God's victories and a mockery to what Israel was under Joshua, that they were listening to God, and that they have stopped, that they are no longer doing so. They are no longer fulfilling that commitment to tell the stories. Now we get to Eglon, one of the favorite little guys in our judges here. Eglon. So what do we know about Eglon?
He's a fat, greasy man.
He's a fat, greasy man. His name means calf. Put those together. We have a fatted calf. We have a fatted calf who is eating rather than being eaten. We also have him in 19 when Ehud comes and says, I have a secret message for you, O king. What does Eglon do? He sends everybody out. Now, first of all, is this a good move for a king?
No.
No, right? What would make a king make everyone go out and be in the company of someone who could be dangerous? What would make him?
He thinks there's going to be a bribe or something. He's going to get some money.
Yeah, it's like, what am I going to get for myself now? So it's this idea of he wants whatever it is for himself. And he says it's a secret message. Okay, so when someone says, oh, I've got a secret, what are we like? You know, and we're almost even like, let's move away, right? We want that for ourselves. That gives us power, right? When I have a secret, when I know a secret, I have a little power. So we're getting a picture, right, of Eglon. We know that he feeds himself a lot, and we know that he wants this secret for himself. Now, unfortunately, in 20, it says he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. I don't know why. They actually took out some of the Hebrew words. And the Hebrew words there actually say, in his cool roof chamber, which he had for himself alone. So the idea of the roof chamber was something he had for himself alone. Now, let's think about what a roof chamber is in that time. Where are they? They're in the desert. Uh-huh. Yeah. And believe me, that desert in the spring that I've been there is 110. So it's hot. He's got a roof chamber, which is going to give him some breezes. I mean, it says it over and over again that it's a cool roof chamber. And what's the purpose of the roof chamber?
So he'd be by himself.
So he's cool by himself, right? Right. He's making sure that his stuff is taken care of, right? It's for himself alone, it says. Now think about that. He has all these people all around him, but I alone am going to have this roof chamber. So you're beginning to see what the culture is that Israel is assimilating into, that Israel has married into. I want it all for myself. And then the fact that roof chamber is mentioned, what, like four times, which is a lot in here. It keeps saying he's in his roof chamber, he's in his roof chamber, he's in his roof chamber. He's always putting himself above everybody else. Right? So we have this culture of the Moabites that came from getting what you want from incest, right? That's where it comes from. Gathering people who are like that, who will prey on the weak. A culture who mocks God's victories and people listening to God. A culture who is feeding themselves, making sure that they get their needs met. That's the culture we have with the Moabites and Eglon. So from here on in, I hope you start looking at the pictures of what God is trying to draw here. Wow. Philistines. So just right now, what we know is the Philistines are an advanced culture. They're exactly opposite of what we portray, right? When we say somebody's a Philistine, what do we say? What do we think? Barbarian. Just the opposite of what they were. They were actually a very advanced culture. We see this at the end of Judges, the fact that they have this huge temple that's in the Cretan architecture style. It's huge, guys. When it tells you all the people that are there, it's huge. They had architecture and art was huge for the Philistines. They also had weaponry. They were the only ones in that area, actually, that made the steel weapons. We see in 1 Samuel that it said not only were they the only ones that made weaponry, they made sure that they kept that secret for themselves so that people had to come to them if they wanted weapons. So it was an industry that they built up for themselves and wouldn't share it with others. And the other big thing about the Philistines was they had two industries, weaponry and alcohol. So they made alcohol. They have found, I think, in some of the digs that their distilleries and their whatever you do to make alcohol. But their industry became one of alcohol and one of overindulgence of alcohol. We see this in the end of Judges with Samson going, he's with the Philistines and he's marrying the Philistines and they're having a feast. That feast is not a food feast. It's a drinking feast. That's just a picture of who the Philistines were. So again, this overindulgence of keeping things for themselves and indulging themselves, feeding themselves, trying to satisfy themselves. So we see the picture of this in not only Philistines, but the Moabites and the Mesopotamians, this culture of, I want to get what I need for myself, this idea of self-satisfaction, going toward what I need to get what I need, pursuing my own desires to build up myself. And for particularly the picture, word picture that they paint here, remember it being an oral tradition, I mean, the thing that you always come away with is fat, right? This talk about fat, this talk about food and alcohol, basically. A lot about food. So that when someone goes toward that to satisfy themselves, they begin to use a gift of God for a different reason. So food is supposed to be pleasurable when it's used for what God made it for, right? When it's used to nourish a body to become more the image of God. They use food in order to satisfy themselves. And there's lots of ways we can satisfy ourselves. How do we satisfy ourselves with food? We want to be comfortable, right? We want to make ourselves feel good when we're feeling bad, right? What other ways do we use food?
Control, either too much or too little.
Okay, control. So we use food. And what happens with idolatry is, we use gifts and we make an aberration of them. So diets, that's using food a way God did not mean, right?
Well, we were talking earlier how now the idol is smallness, but then the idol is largeness.
Right, right, exactly. So there's the idol's largeness, ours is smallness. Some of us still do use food for comforting ourselves and making us feel good. It's still all control. It's still all about, I want to eat this and I'm going to eat this, rather than finding the pleasure in, wow, God, you've given me this to nourish my body so that it can be naming and tending and flourishing. So there's always an aberration of a gift that God's given in idolatry. And that's what's happening here. And I bring out food because this is what God brings out. I mean, he brings out fat so many times in here that it actually becomes one of the keywords in there. Why do you think that's one of the first nations that we encounter with a lot of information? Do you think maybe this is still a problem? Food as an idol? Do you think it's always been a problem as an idol? Yeah, I think that's why God brings it out here so much. I have 2 minutes. This is what we're going to do. We're going to go to Ehud and just end with one thing. So we talked about Othniel. We kind of know. So what I'm going to be doing throughout these is understanding what's happening with the nations, with Israel, And every time it's happening with Israel, us, with the judges, whatever judge that is being raised up at that time, and then, of course, with God. Because remember, again, it's God's story. What's God doing? And you can almost always answer, what's God doing? He's keeping covenant. He is drawing them back to himself. He is making sure that they have experience to understand that what they've gone toward isn't giving them life. So that's always what God is doing every time in these. But let's look at Ehud for just a second. Who he was, a deliverer, it says, and it says he was a Benjamite, which is interesting because you know what the name Benjamite means? Son of my right hand. He's a Benjamite, and that's why they put this in here. He's a Benjamite who, and it says left-handed, the actual words mean deformed in his right hand. He's a son of right hand, which means strength, who has no strength, who has right hand. For this culture, to be left-handed, to be deformed in your right hand, means that you were useless. You were seen as weak and useless and not a threat at all, which is why he's also a tribute bearer. He and a tribute bearer is, what would the New Testament call a tribute bearer? Tax collector. That's what he is. So he is not seen as anything. Yeah, he's not a threat to the Moabites, and he is certainly not a deliverer in the Israel's eyes, in the Israelites' eyes, because he's left-handed. He has no strength. He has nothing for us. But what does he do? He makes a two-edged sword. The actual word there is a two-mouthed sword. So again, we keep on getting these ideas of mouth and eating and food. And he uses his weakness. So the reason he could do what he did, when it is very deliberate, and when it says where he put his sword, where does he put his sword?
His right thigh,
which means his left hand can grab it from here. That's how they would have done it. They would have not, the people bringing him into the king would have examined his left thigh to see. They would have also looked at his hand and said, yeah, no big deal. So he can come in and do that. He chose vulnerability because when he comes in, he tells his helpers to leave. And he is alone with the king. And remember what vulnerability means? Willing to be wounded. He's willing, for the sake of Israel, for the sake of what God's told him to do, to be wounded. He does that because these people might get hurt. And he's not going to let that happen. And then, of course, we have him turning back from the idols at Gilgal. And what the word turn back actually means is a movement back to the point of departure. So what that means is he's at Gilgal. He sees that at Gilgal, those idols. And he, in his attitude, goes back to, wait, what happened at Gilgal? God removed the reproach. God was with us. God worked. And he goes back to, no, we are going to go back to that. And I'm going to lead that. I'm going to lead us going back to what Gilgal really was, not idols. He gives God's message and not his own. And of course, we can go into a lot of things here because we know he has a two-edged sword. We know it's God's word. We know that God's word is as a two-edged sword. It can separate Moan and Barrow. He goes first in destroying the enemy, which is what a priest does, right? A priest goes first to encourage and invite others. And then he calls Israel, okay, now Israel, let's do it. And the fight, the battle, is at Gilgal. So when it says he passes again by the idols, I found very little commentary on this, very little ideas on what does it mean that he passed by again here. What perhaps it means is the fact that this is where the battle's going to go. It's like, okay, look, guys, the idols, remember, they're not supposed to be there. This is Gilgal. And it's this, come on, let's do it. And he brings Israel to defeat the Moabites. And he gives the Lord credit. He says, God has given them into your hands. And I really like that about Ehud. He took all of this and did what he does, bringing we could go into the whole idea of him putting the knife into Eglon, and what comes out of Eglon is his refuse, right? This is, he's fed himself so much that this is all he is about. It's also because it wouldn't be obvious that he was murdered. It looks like he just fell off. By the way, and you know what it means when it says he's in the cool chain, he's probably just relieving himself. They think he's going to the bathroom in there. And why do they think he's going to the bathroom? Because they can smell it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, that's what happened, right?
No.
Yeah. You're supposed to get that visceral from this. You're supposed to. It stinks. It's horrible to be that kind of a lifestyle. And then they get rest for 80 years. Shamgar, just on the side, I really like that there's one sense about Shamgar, but it's great. First of all, Shamgar is not a Hebrew name, so he probably was a Gentile that did this for Israel. He's probably a farmer, because what's his tool? An ox goad. An ox goad. And who's he going against?
600
Philistines. Philistines. What are the Philistines known for? Steel weaponry and iron chariots. And he kills them with an ox goad. He kills them with what he has and who he is. He's probably a farmer. All he has is an ox goad. And yet he does that. What I want us to see from Othniel, by the way, Othniel is the son of the youngest brother of Caleb, which is a derogatory term, basically. Right? Well, because he's the least of. He's not Caleb's son. He's Caleb's youngest brother's son. It's like, no, way down there. Ehud, he's left-handed. Shamgar, not only a Gentile, but a farmer with an ox goad. And we have all of them using what doesn't look like it can be a piece of a way to deliver. What looks like weakness in the world's eyes, it is done by, God says, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, by Zoe, by my breath, is how life comes about. And that's kind of what we see with the judges here. So what I'd like you to do, and I'm sorry, I'm 5 minutes over. I would like you to examine for yourself to understanding us. Because you need to understand your own culture, your family culture, your friend culture, your city culture, your church culture, your country culture, your ethnicity culture. What's important to them? Where do they think an end goal is? And that's why I asked about food in your family. So I want you to start thinking about your own culture. It's also what's going to happen with your maps. You're going to start thinking about that. And whether you've made your own agreements according to your culture, whether your family culture. And I think family culture is really important because we don't examine that. We examine like the outside culture, right? But we don't examine our family culture so much. Because it's the first place you're going to get some magnetic pulls toward. And then your own personal pulls toward. So go through that, understanding us. That will be your application of kind of what we can do with this. So, Father, I thank you for so much richness and so much revealing of the fact that we are Israelites. And we have done evil in your sight. And we have bowed to the gods of the gods of the people that are around us. Father, I pray that we would remember that we have a deliverer who delivers through breath rather than might. We thank you for that deliverer. In Jesus' name, amen.
Go forth into the world in peace, rejoicing in the power of the Spirit.
Thanks be to God.